Good evening, everybody. We're continuing. Hopefully my throat holds up. It's been kind of weak lately, so I will go as far as I can. We are going to be studying tonight the Maharit, Rav Yosef ben Moshe Trani, who, just so you realize, even though you may never have heard of him, and he doesn't take the normal path that we might expect of poskim. Just to give you an example, the Chazon Ish thought he was the greatest of the responsa writers in history. And the Chazon Ish's opinion should not be taken lightly. He was a pretty significant halachist of the last generation. So when he says something about that, something like that about you, so your ear should perk up. In that sense. He's also not off the beaten path because he also leads us to discussing a society we have yet to discuss, which is the Jews of Turkey, particularly Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, but it was Constantinople. Why they changed it, I can't say. Maybe they just liked it better that way.
Wasn't Constantinople Christian.
Ah, so why is that important? Why is
these guys got it?
I guess they just don't know the tune. So let's go through a little bit of history of the Jews under the Ottoman Empire. So number one, until 1453, the Jews weren't under the Ottoman Empire. What were they under? Whatever the pre-Turkish Roman Empire was. It was a Christian empire, and it was basically the last vestige of the Holy Roman Empire.
Byzantine.
It's the last vestige of the Holy Roman Empire. So it is profoundly Christian. It is under the major influence of the Pope, and it's also, to a certain extent, considered an interloper in that area, because imagining, even after almost 1,000 years... in Turkey, they were still viewed as an invading empire. That being said, the Ottomans were considered local, and the Ottomans begin to grow this kind of small empire in the Middle East, leading all the way into Turkey, and comes along Sultan Mehmed II. In 1453, he decides he's going to take Constantinople. It was, from all historical accounts, a long and drawn-out siege. But ultimately, the Ottomans take Constantinople. Interestingly enough, they did not change it almost instantaneously to Istanbul. It remained Constantinople for a while. But he comes in there and he causes what was once a very, very cosmopolitan city, with various Greek and non-Greek intellectuals, to suddenly turn over into an entirely different type of a city. You have a lot of people fleeing, and you have this great historical city without kind of its historical characters that have really made that city over generations. Also, why this was a significant moment, because it is the final nail in the coffin of the Holy Roman Empire. This was a major blow to the Pope, a major blow to that entire kind of vision of a Christian world. That being said, Mehmed II was not interested in imposing some sort of theocracy in Constantinople, or in the Ottoman Empire for that matter. He wanted it to remain cosmopolitan, and even though there was some debate as to what the status of others who were non-Muslim would be in that society, he clearly wants it to remain kind of the broad-minded and cosmopolitan city that it was under Christian rule, and so he takes on this massive project of resettling Muslims, Christians, and Jews from all over the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople in order that there should be a mixed society, to the point where at various points in history, Jews were an influential 10% of the city. They were influential in general in the Ottoman Empire, so much so that later in during Ottoman rule, the remember Israel or Palestine at this point is under the rule of the Ottomans. At one point, there were almost 1,500 Jews living in Jerusalem at its height, with the blessing of the Ottomans because of it. And in fact, it was said in those days, is it not better to live under Muslims than under Christians? The Jews of the Ottoman period very much embrace their rulers, particularly if you were living in Turkey. So much so that Ashkenaz Jews begin to join in the late 1400s. By the time you get to Benghazi II at the beginning of the 16th century, he is actively recruiting Sephardic Jews who were expelled from Spain and Portugal, actively recruiting to the point where he sends a formal invitation to expel Jews. The statement is, "Ye call Ferdinand the Wise, who makes his land poor and ours rich." So why was he so interested? Hold on one second. Why was he so interested in having Jews? So let's remember. Number one is Christians can't take ribbis from one another under the fiat of the Pope. They can't take interest from one another. Muslims under Sharia law can't take interest from one another. So you have this great growing living cosmopolitan society with an immense need for bankers to bankroll this cosmopolitan society and to build up the economy there. So the Jews were the perfect ones to play this role, and they were invited, embraced, and brought into the Ottoman Empire, particularly in Turkey, and I want to focus on that for a little bit, particularly in Turkey, and that's why so many Jews came there. It also created kind of an interesting system, because what you had was probably the most diverse Jewish community. It's probably only comparable to maybe today what's going on in New York or in Israel. Because what do you have? You have native Turkish Jews who've been living there for 600-700 years, you know, for generations. You have this influx of Ashkenazi Jews from Western and Eastern Europe. And then you throw onto that, you have these historical Sephardic Jews who are all coming in. And as you can imagine, the fights and the arguments were immense. It was not the most unified Jewish community that there ever was in history. And there were a great deal of fights and arguments that went on during these times. I wrote here Jew versus Jew. There's a lot of Jew versus Jew hatred going on in these times between the Ashkenazic and the Sephardic and the Turkish communities that are all really butting heads in terms of it. Why? Because everything's being run under the millet system. What is the millet system? So Benghazid and most of the sultans of the Ottoman Empire, despite the breadth of their empire, they were very much a live and let live type of government. They were not, I guess they were the first libertarians in that sense, that they very much believed that every community in and of itself should have its own autonomy. So it imposed, for lack of a better word, a millet system. The millet system basically said that every grouping of communities gets to be a state within a state. What does that mean? So even though I'm living in one house, and next door is my Muslim neighbor, and on the other side is my Christian neighbor, each one of us is going to be governed, even though we're living in the same block, each one of us is going to be governed by a different set of laws. Right, the Christians will be beholden to Christian law, the Muslims will be beholden to Sharia law, and the Jews will be beholden to halakha, as decided by their rabbinical court system, led by the Chacham Bashi. The Chacham Bashi was this rabbinic elected figure who would be the representative to the Ottoman government with anything that might be interesting or germane to the Jewish community. But ultimately, the Jewish community was self-governing. Again, a very odd situation. Also, because because the Turkish government was very live and let live, it also left a kind of, I guess, diametrically opposing experiences between, let's say, the Jews living under Ottoman rule in the land of Israel as opposed to the Jews living in Turkey. In Turkey, you have cosmopolitan people and cosmopolitan Turks and cosmopolitan Muslims. Muslims who very much share the same kind of perspective of the Turkish government, of the live and let live, you know, everyone let them be what they're going to be. You know, you're a Jew, you're a Christian, I'm a Muslim, let's all move up as long as you remain. This was one of the big things. As long as you remain humble and recognize, you know, who the real boss is here, we're all fine, everything's, wonderful, you can do whatever you want. Whereas in the, in Israel, you're having a much more virulent Muslim community who's very unhappy with a Jewish community within their midst. And again, the Turkish, the Ottoman government is not going to do a lot to try to get involved in these kind of, back and forth, confrontations that are going on there. So the Turkish government's going to stay out of it. So that leaves the Jewish community very, very vulnerable to Islamic attacks, which was one of par for the course in the late 15th and 16th centuries. Okay, that's what's going on, and you're having kind of this opposing experiences. You know, a Jew from Constantinople might say, "Oh, I love the Ottomans," and a Jew from Jerusalem might say, "Oh, I hope the Ottomans go to hell," because the Jew from Jerusalem is looking at the Ottomans as the people who aren't protecting them from the local Muslims who are attacking them regularly. That's kind of the background to the community in Constantinople. Yeah.
You know, like you said about the Golden Age, living there and stuff. Isn't it true, though, and again, it means so much different things, that the Jews were still considered second-class citizens, that their shuls weren't allowed to be higher than a mosque, that they still were considered dhimmis? I mean, they still, maybe they weren't persecuted in pogroms, but they still were considered second-class citizens.
There was a basic humility that was required of all non-Ottomans, but like I said, I wouldn't call it a golden age, but it was certainly good times for that.
Yeah, where they were coming from being, oppressed in other countries.
Yeah, no, listen, if you're comparing anything to the United States of America, the answer is, you're right, everyone was a slave, compared to the United States of America. I mean, listen, compared to Europe. They were a slave. It was probably more like, I don't even know, there's no comparable situation like this anymore. This was par for the course in those days. This was the most progressive, tolerant, democratic society that ever, they're self-governing, they have the right to build their synagogues, they're wealthy, they're involved in the economic system. Like, you couldn't ask for more in those days for Jews unless, the Messianic era, from their perspective.
Israel, like you said about the hatred with the Jews, I think that being carried to 1914. There was pogroms already in Israel by the Arabs.
Correct. But until the 20th century, Jews in Arab lands were generally well treated. I think I forgot who it was that said it quite eloquently. He said, even if you count the entire 20th century, the Muslim world has a long way to go before they catch up with Christian anti-Semitism. Right, like we're talking about, 2,000 years of persecution, almost the entire history of Christianity.
Well, it's starting to catch up now. They
only have about 750 more years of persecution to go before they make a dent in it. So that's kind of the issue that's going on there. Into this world is born Rav Yosef ben Moshe of Trani. He is born in Safed in 1570. However, in his early days, somewhere in the mid-1580s, there is a black plague that is spreading in Sfat, and he is forced to leave the area when he is very young. He has to cut his learning short under the learning of Rav Shlomo Sages, But nonetheless, he's one of he's born during the very, very end of the Shulchan Aruch, of Rav Yosef Karo's life. He is blessed by the Shulchan Aruch. And this, throughout the lore and legend of the Maharit, of Rav Yosef of Trani, so around the lawyers, there was great stock placed in this blessing that he received from the Shulchan Aruch, and many believe that to have been kind of the great promoter and inspiration for the fact that he became the great halachist that he was. He moves on to study in Damascus under an unnamed scholar. Okay, who it is, we know not, but he spends a good deal of time there, and he comes out a well-respected scholar. They knew he was extraordinarily bright when he was young, but when he returns to Tzfat in the 1590s, he comes with a reputation as an exceptional and unparalleled scholar, first-class halachist, etc., etc. And a yeshiva is opened in Tzfat for him to become the head of it. There, his reputation continues to grow, particularly through his responsa. Many people go to him for some very serious shilas. His influence kind of crosses the broad range of religious areas throughout Europe. He's answering questions, certainly in Turkey and Sephardic lands. He's answering questions, and so when you have and as the community in Tzfat becomes poorer and poorer, and they can't pay their taxes, again the local neighborhood natives, they decide to put him in jail in order to levy more money from the community. He realizes that things can't continue the way they are. And in 1604, the extraordinarily wealthy Ibn Ya'ish brothers come together to raise funds in order to entice Rav Yosef ben Moshe of Trani to come to the community in Turkey. They raise a great deal of funds. They offer him a yeshiva, a shul, the works. They're going to treat him in a mechubadik way. Some of the community records record the fact that he was a fairly savvy negotiator, to the point where he negotiated as part of his salary a share in their investments or their companies. But so desperate were they for a Talmid Chacham first class of Rav Yosef and Moshe of Trani that they agreed to his insistences, and he moves on to Constantinople, where he becomes a rabbi there and ultimately the rabbi there. So much so where, according to many, he becomes the greatest halachist of his time. And the decisions that he makes are ones which continue to reverberate. For example, just to give you, in terms of his influence on the halachic realm, there is a sefer on the Shulchan Aruch called the Pischei Tshuva. The Pischei Tshuva is on the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch, and it collects, basically, questions that were dealt with that relate to whatever halachic topic is being written about in the Shulchan Aruch, kind of more contemporary type questions that are there. And if you saw how many times the Maharit is quoted, you'd be amazed. He's quoted numerous, numerous times. So clearly the Maharit is someone who had was very much a halachic force. So one of the things, so just a couple of the things that he did during his time. So number one is he was an anti-Karaite crusader. This is one of his major quests when he came to Turkey, was rejection of the literalist leanings of those who would read non-halachically into the Torah, and he was one of the great anti-Karaite crusaders. Not that there were many, it was a massive Karaite community at the time, but nonetheless, if they were to kind of reemerge, they knew they had a formidable enemy in the form of Rav Yosef ben Moshe of Trani. The Maharid also, as the leader of the Constantinople community, had to deal with a fairly complicated issue. And that was, you didn't have a specific Jewish monetary system, but you had a shared monetary system for the Ottoman Empire. That monetary system was subject to inflation. And he's one of the first people to start dealing with the fact that, wait a minute, inflation might have an effect on what? On ribis, on the taking of interest, right? Because what happens? I'm willing to give you $10 now, even though you're going to give me $10 later, but the $10 you give me later won't be the same $10 I gave you now, especially if things are moving. And so he was a real kind of creative thinker in this area of how to deal with inflationary issues that related to halacha. He has a whole section of Eshelos V'Tshuvos on Choshen Mishpat, on tort law, and on monetary law, and he deals with a lot of those issues. Another place where you'll hear the name of Rav Yosef of the Maharit quoted is particularly in the issue of abortion. Why? Because he dealt with this issue of aborting fetuses, and he makes the claim that the abortion of a fetus is not murder in Jewish law, but it is, he says, chavala. What does that mean? Chavala is causing of a wound in another person. So the Maharit took the position that if I were to abort someone's child, it would be equivalent of chopping off their finger or chopping off their arm. And therefore the same laws in halachot would apply. There is a prohibition of chavala, right? You're not allowed to chop off someone's finger unless you're saving their life, or even not necessarily for saving their life, but potentially in order to improve their life. You might be able to do it in some way if you could create some sort of situation where that would be allowed. Chavala ba'atzmacha is not allowed. You're not allowed to say, well, I don't mind, you can go cut off my finger. You're not allowed to do that. It's, you know, God gave you a gift of a body, you have certain responsibilities. But once the Maharit starts talking about it as chavala, it opens a whole new door of understanding and comprehension in this issue. That's why in all the medical ethics books, if you ever see the discussion of abortion, it's going to relate specifically to this Maharit because of his very innovative depiction of the whole thing, and it has become fairly standard thought. Rav Moshe takes a little bit more of a stringent opinion, but many others take this Maharit very seriously. Another issue that he dealt with, Safek Derabanan Lekula, the issue of Safek Derabanan Lekula, of that when there is doubt, when it comes to rabbinic law, we take the more lenient position. And there's the famous question of if all rabbinic law is ultimately merely the fulfillment of biblical law, so then shouldn't it be Safek Daraisa Lechumra? So here he makes the claim that the rabbis knew that they were doing something innovative when they were establishing new law, and because they knew they were doing something innovative when they were establishing new law, therefore they built it in as a subcategory within all rabbinic systems that it is that you take the more lenient opinion and don't be stringent with it because they knew they were establishing new law. It's kind of an interesting interpretation. Another issue that he deals with is that people quote him on is walking on Har Habayit. Remember, he, at least for part of his time, is in the land of Israel and also spends a few years back and forth between Jerusalem and Tzfat. And once he was there, he dealt with the issue of whether one in this day and age is permitted to walk on the Temple Mount. And he does allow for walking on the Temple Mount in certain areas. He actually wrote a whole kuntres about it. He does allow for the walking on the Temple Mount in certain areas, assuming you've gone to mikvah that morning. And another one of the interesting aspects of his tshuvos is kind of these, he has like these personal advice columns. People will write to him that they failed at a certain sin, and they want to know how to do teshuvah over those sins, and he'll give, you know, like little pieces of advice, you know, personal, practical halachic advice, how you should improve it, you know, what you need to do to have a better life. So he's kind of like, you know, even he's like a Dear of Moshe and a Dear Abbey altogether. Those are some of the more kind of engaging ones, you know, just in terms of, you know, you should fast every Thursday because it'll teach you, you know, greater, you know, a way to control yourself a little bit more, you know, how to control your anger and focus it, you know, focus your emotions on more positive things. You know, he has like these little advice columns, so people are really looking to him. And again, what makes him fascinating, and I think really kind of a seminal figure, is the fact that he doesn't really fit into any kind of specific category. He's not a Safed mystic, you know, like the Ari. He's not a classical Ashkenazic halachist. He's not a, you know, philosopher from Sfarad. He's kind of his own person. He does his own thing. He has his own perspective, and he becomes, like I said, this massively influential rabbinic figure during his day. Also, if you want just some kind of an interesting fact, he was buried in Constantinople. His children exhumed his body and had it brought to the land of Israel, where it was found only recently outside Sfat. And the reason it was found was because, anyone guess? They wrote this very long epitaph upon his tombstone that was preserved. If you want some of, there's been some great literature written about the particular epitaph that's been written. But so he was buried in Constantinople, and only later on, fairly recently, in the areas near Tzfat, he was found. His grave was found. So if you're looking for an interesting tourist site in the land of Israel, next time you're there, you can go visit the grave of the Maharit, who, despite being traveling in some many Kabbalistic circles, so I don't know if you pray by his grave if it'll have any Kabbalistic significance, but listen, if you're going to the Rambam's grave, you know, a great halachist, then, you know, you might as well go also to the Maharit's grave also, if you're looking for one of the great halachists of our history. And that is the Maharit, kind of in a nutshell. Questions, comments.
So just going to go back, was he originally a Sfar?
He's Sfardi. He's from Tzfat. So he's from the refugees from Spain. But he doesn't stay in Tzfat long enough to really become a mystic in that sense. Although, you know, who knows when you became a mystic, but it's clear he was heading towards the path of halachas right from the beginning. And not only that, but someone creative, bold, you know, in that sense of it. Yeah. Yeah, but I feel like everyone becomes a Rosh Hashiva when they're really young in those